Game Bros.
Hello, listeners.
Hey, hello.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games, board game design, and board gaming as a hobby.
Yep.
So this is one of our regularly scheduled weekly episodes where we talk about a particular game. And Matthew, it should be noted that today is your birthday.
Yay.
Happy birthday, Matthew.
Thank you.
Tell the people how old you are. Or don't. Don't tell
it's whatever.
It's up to you.
But this game is actually one that I admit I got for my birthday.
And we played.
And we played it, and it was very fun.
Yep.
It's also a pretty recent game, and I want to mention something real quick. There is a term in the board gaming community of Cult of the New, which is sort of like a flavor of the month type of thing, where it's like people sort of have a tendency to focus a lot on new games and then kind of skip over older games when new ones come out. I'm not doing this necessarily because it's new. I think it's good to talk about new games. But, like, I want it to be known that, like, you know, we try to not just go with the hype waves.
Sure.
But this one is very good.
I mean,
this
how many episodes did it take us to talk about
Scythe?
Yeah.
This is, of course, Spirit Island.
Yes, we're talking about the cooperative board game Spirit Island.
So designed by R. Eric Royce, mm-hmm. Published by Greater Than Games Fabled Nexus in 2017, and it was nominated for a ton of stuff for Golden Geek 2017. I don't even have the full list because it was pretty large. Just go to the Board Game Geek page for it. Mm-hmm. And from what I remember, it had a pretty high spot on the overall ranking for a while, like mm-hmm. top five.
Oh, yeah, wow.
Yeah. And this is a cooperative game, and also, it's another game with a ton of content in the box, and we only did the sort of beginner mode of it.
Right. We tried to play the beginner mode at Geekway. We mentioned Spirit Island in our Geekway recap episode.
We also mentioned that we messed up.
Yeah, we messed up because, as you'll learn later, there's this mechanic called the Invader deck, and we totally shuffled it in the wrong way and made the game way more difficult than it needed to be for a beginner set of players.
Anyways, and this time we messed up by making it too easy, but that's another thing.
Yeah, although, you know, I think
We'll talk about it.
Okay, so let me give a brief description of what Spirit Island is.
Yep.
So, in Spirit Island, players are spirits who are working together to drive back the invading colonials in order to protect the spirits' island and the native Dahan people that live there.
I thought it was Dahan.
Dahan? Well, Dahan works for me. I can switch it. Players take turns strengthening their spirits' abilities and planning which of their powers they will use in order to damage the invaders, push them or the Dahan to other parts of the island, bolster the defenses of the Dahan, or generate fear in the colonials. After deliberating as a team, the spirit's plan is executed. Fast actions resolve first, slow actions resolve last, and in between the fast and the slow action resolutions, the colonists get their own turn to expand to new parts of the island, build their own defenses, and ravage the lands that they occupy. Players win by removing the colonist threat entirely, or partially if enough fear has been generated, and players lose if the land becomes too ravaged or the Dahan become wiped out. So that's just a short description of it. You have these large tiles that are divided into many different territories, and you put them together at the beginning of the game to make up the island. The map starts with some Dahan on the island. It starts with some invaders, and play progresses. Invaders try to expand and grow and damage the land, and you try to push them back. So,
All right,
let's get deeper into how the game is played and how the strategy is played.
I want to start with the spirits.
Well, I would actually like to start first by explaining in a little more detail how the colonists work.
Okay, sure.
So, the colonists. Every board has little icons on the different territories in them that note what starts there. And these only come up at the beginning of the game when you're setting up. The icons could either note whether a number of Dahan huts start there or whether different colonial structures start there. The different colonial structures are there's just a colonist, just a little human character. There's a village, which is just a small structure, and then there's a city, which is a larger structure. So they start on the board. And then what?
There's one more thing that can start on the board for blight. Those symbols. Blight.
Yes, okay. So they start on the board, and on the colonist's turn, they have a deck of cards. They start with the first card revealed, and that is the exploration card. Or it's in the exploration slot of the colonist's turns. It starts on the top of the deck, and then it slowly moves to the left after each turn. So when a card is face up in the explore area, the colonists will expand to that, to the lands that are, to that type of land that is shown on the explore deck. Each card in the colonist deck has a different type of land. It could be mountains, forest, wetlands, or desert. So they explore, meaning any of those lands near the coast of the island, or any of those lands near or in the same territory as a village or city. So the colonists expand from the coast and from their own cities. And usually, at the beginning of the game, that's everywhere. There's no exception to any lands. Every land of that type revealed at the beginning of the game will be explored too. When a card is in the build slot on the colonist's progression turn action track, When a land is in the build slot, then every human piece, the little soldier character, colonist token, in one of the lands of that type, they build in that territory. If there is no village in that territory, they will build a village. If there is already a village in that territory, then they upgrade the village to a city. Then, in the ravage portion, the colonists and the buildings that they have built, they deal damage to the land. So a lone colonist will deal 1 damage to the land, a village deals 2 damage to the land, and a city deals 3 damage to the land. And a number of things happen because of that damage. If there are Dahan in the same territory as the colonists when they ravage the land, they can be wiped out. It takes 2 damage to wipe out a Dahan. So if a colonist or village or city deals at least 2 damage to the land, then they will wipe out a Dahan. And if they deal more, then there's a chance that they wipe out more Dahan from that space. In addition, if at least 2 damage is dealt to the land, then they will add a blight to that land. And blight is one of the big lose conditions for players. If a land already has blight on it, then not only will they add more blight to the land, but the blight will spread to other lands nearby. Other territories, kind of like in Pandemic, how disease spreads. So that's how they work. And then cards will start in the exploration portion of the board, and then it'll move to build, then it'll move to ravage, and then it will be discarded, and more cards will come in after it.
You missed one part of the ravage phase.
What's that?
Which is after colonists are done dealing damage, the remaining Dahan that survived will fight back.
Yes.
Dahan deals 2 damage to the settlers on its tile, on its space, and the health is the same as the damage that the settlers deal. So the people have 1 health, the towns have 2,
yes,
and the cities have 3.
Right. So to just illustrate, if there's a settler and a village in a territory with 2 Dahan, they will deal 3 damage to the land. That will remove 1 Dahan and add a blight to the land. Then that 1 remaining Dahan will fight back, and he will remove the village. Technically, the order that I introduce these actions is opposite of how they occur in the game. In the game, it starts with the ravaging territories, then it goes to the build territories, then it goes to the explore territories, just because every time you use it, then you shift it to the left, right, and that would create the space for the next one to occur.
A better way to say would be that left to right is how it happens in a single round.
Mm-hmm.
Right to left is how a single card progresses through,
yes,
and how the space that is on the card you know, evolves and reacts.
Right. So the turn order is Ravage, Build, Explore. But a card will start on the Explore space, and it will travel to Build, and then to Ravage, and then it will be discarded. Okay. So let's talk about
spirits
and the strategy involved in playing this
game. So we talked about the island, now we talked about the spirits.
Yes, the characters which you are playing.
And so there are, I think, 8 spirits in the box. They are all very different from each other. And so the spirits all have a board, and the board has a couple main areas.
We could call it a placard.
Sure, a placard, a tableau.
Mm-hmm.
The main area to start off with is cards played and energy per turn. So this is what controls what you play your power cards, which are abilities on cards that you have. Each spirit starts with 4, mm-hmm. and you can gain more over the course of the game. And
each card usually has a cost to playing them.
Which is energy.
They have a range, which is a that you control on the board, and they have an effect that, or they also have a speed.
Yeah.
And they have an effect that will involve dealing damage or manipulating the pieces.
These are the main ways you interact with the board in the game.
Yes.
This tableau where these energy and cards played. You start with a pretty small amount, and then the rest of the spaces that show you, like your energy or your cards played mm-hmm. with higher numbers are covered by these wooden discs.
Yes.
This is your presence as your spirit. You start with some already on the board, and each spirit has different instructions. And on your turn, you'll take one of 3 actions that can, like, give you presence, or not on your turn, at the start of a round.
Yes.
It'll give you presence, which means you remove one from the middle part of your board, place it in an appropriate range determined by the action you took
mm-hmm.
on the main board.
This is kind of like upgrades in Scythe.
Yeah.
Where a single piece is serving 2 functions.
Right.
And this, when it's at the start of the game, a piece is covering up your upgrades. It's like a tracker.
Yeah.
And the pieces are covering up. So you start at the left end of the tracker to remove the pieces so that your thing upgrades as you remove more pieces. And also when you remove a piece from these trackers that show the strength of your spirit, you are then placing that on the board, and that becomes your presence.
And that is what determines how far your powers can affect.
Yes.
And also, there is, so below that, there are innate powers. Innate powers are gained as, like, a side effect if you play enough of certain power cards.
Right.
Each power card has a number of elements on the side filled in.
Mm-hmm.
And your innate powers require you to have a certain number of elements shown. Usually, there's, like, each spirit will care about maybe 3 elements, and you'll usually need, like, 2 of one and 1 of the other for your cheapest one.
Mm-hmm. And there's like 7 or 8 different elements per card that they have the possibility of being attributed to, but they usually only have like 2 or 3 elements to each card.
Yeah, and your spirit always starts with cards that give that care about the elements that your innate powers cost.
Yes.
Your innate powers tend to be a little weaker overall. I mean, it depends on the spirit, but they're bonus actions, so it helps. They also have a speed and a range.
Mm-hmm.
And then each spirit also has a sort of like baseline special effect that helps determine their playstyle.
Yes.
And this is a big part of the game, is that each spirit plays very differently. Each has different roles, different actions they can do, different purposes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
So let's dig in a little bit about the strategy in this game. This is a cooperative game. So obviously work together.
Yeah, that's obvious.
But something to note in this game. Oh, and obviously you're gonna take calculated risks in this game, because in cooperative games like this, where there is this this threat that you cannot entirely manage all the time, you have to just pick your battles where you're going to push them back and where you're going to just accept their the harm that they're dealing to the land. Because it's too big a thing to manage just from the beginning. So, one thing that's very important to learn early on in this game is the fact that... you can see the invaders' actions. Mm-hmm. You can see, you know, what lands they're exploring, what lands that they're going to build in, and what lands they're going to ravage in. And you know that when they explore a land, eventually they're going to build and ravage in it. So your cards in this game, they have a speed, fast and slow. The fast act before the invaders and the slow act after the invaders, and most of the cards in the game are slow. So that should tell you that most of the cards that you have access to at any given point in the game are not going to work on the turn that you play them. You're not really even playing them that turn. You're paying for them, but their effect is more so it's affecting the invaders for their next turn.
Yeah.
That's important to grasp, and that will lead you to realize that it's important to try and fight back the invaders as early on as possible in their action progression. Because if you think about it, the first turn they make a soldier, the second turn that soldier makes a village, the third turn they have enough power to add a blight to the land.
And blight runs out pretty quickly.
Yes. You, depending on the scenario, you can start with anywhere from 5 blight per person to
2.
It's, yeah, there's, so the basic scenario that we played, you just have 5 blight per person, and if all the blight is gone, then the game ends. In other scenarios, you start with 2 blight per person as an initial pool, and when that one runs out, then you go to a second rule set. There's more blight added to the game per person, which you will lose if that second pool is eliminated. But it also adds additional rules that act against the players. In the base version, if you run out of blight, you lose. Anyways,
if you can affect them like right after their explore action, that means they don't build a town, so you don't have to worry about getting rid of that.
Yes.
And then they don't have enough damage to deal to.
I mean, we talked about how it takes 1 damage to destroy a person, mm-hmm. It takes 2 damage to destroy a village. So it's way easier. I mean, if you just deal 1 damage to a person the turn that they explore, that's almost as if you had dealt 3 damage to the person in that village on a later turn.
It's also worth noting that once they have 2 or more damage, then 1 Dahan hut is not enough to stop. Whereas if they just have 1 damage on a space and there's a Dahan hut, the Dahan will just kill the person immediately action.
It's one of the most comfortable things to happen in the game. It feels real nice when there's just a single invader on a space.
Yeah.
They only deal 1 damage to the land, so that's not enough to mm-hmm. give it a blight token. But if there's a Dahan there, technically they did ravage that land, and so the Dahan mm-hmm. get to counterattack and just wipe out that one guy.
Yeah, definitely try to think ahead.
Always think ahead
1 turn at least, if not two.
There was a thing that kept happening in our game, which was that we would get so concerned with all the guys that were acting that were like ravaging that turn that we would sort of lose sight of the turns to come.
Yeah, we really fell behind a turn.
Exactly. If you pay too much attention to what's happening this turn in the ravaging portion of the colonists' actions, then you lose sight of the building and the exploring, and then that will get out of hand the next turn. And if you pay attention to the ravaging, then it just sort of cascades.
When you think about it, since most actions are slow, there is 1 spirit in the beginner setup that could make other people's actions fast.
Mm-hmm.
But that was on 1 card that you have to take a special action on part of your start of round effects to get the cards you've already played back into your hand. And that cost a lot of resources to try to get our slow actions ready every turn to stop the ones we were worried about that turn.
Right.
So it saves on resources and time and all that if you can worry more about at least what's already on the build space.
Right. We almost fell into a trap with that card because one player was playing the Lightning Spirit, which had the card that allowed that could speed up cards of other players. If they would be slow, they could turn them into fast cards. But yes, that takes a lot of the resources of the Lightning player's turn.
And they can't develop presence as easily, too.
Although they had the best starting resource gain, they could play two cards and gain like one spirit or something, or maybe even two spirit at the beginning of the game. Which was good, and they weren't set too far behind because they started with a fast play style that could afford to play that extra card every turn. But yes, we almost asked too much of them in order to just speed up some of our cards, and the cards didn't really need to be sped up because, you know, we were doing what we were talking about, which was we were losing sight of what was to come by focusing too much on what was happening that turn in the ravaging phase.
But now we know, and now you know.
Yes, now you know. So
another important...
Well, I just wanted to reiterate.
Sure, yeah.
Destroying a colonist when he's just a colonist, you know, destroy them while they're young, I guess. Yeah. Because they will grow and they will blight the land, and it's much easier to deal one damage than it is to deal three.
Don't give the mouse a cookie.
Yes.
But another thing I wanted to say is Dahan are one of the most important resources for maintaining the board. Because we mentioned that Dahan will fight back. And like we said, if there's one settler and they attack and then the Dahan fight back, it's fine. The settler's gone. A good amount of spirits can defend using their powers. And there's a number of powers that you can get through the game that defend.
And when we say powers, we do those remember that we're talking about cards.
Yeah, and defend means that the settlers do less damage both to the huts and the land. So that's really important too, because I mean, like, a lot of the basic powers that deal damage only deal two, maybe three, which is only enough to wipe out one village or maybe one city or something. Whereas the Dahan, since there's a lot more ways to move Dahan around through gathering and pushing, which, you know, let you either get ones from...
We'll get into gathering and pushing in a second.
But so since there's a lot of ways to move Dahan, it's a lot more efficient to be able to gather them, save them from dying, and then make them fight back and deal a ton of damage that way.
Yeah, they're free damage. And so if you can... And it's... Yeah, more often than not, it's easier to move them and protect them than it is to deal direct damage.
There are very, very few ways to actually make new Dahan. So trying to keep as many alive early game helps you transition into late game better.
And you don't want them to get wiped out.
Oh, yeah. I think that's actually a losing condition.
It is.
Also, fear. There is a pool of fear tokens, and then you have fear cards. Now, at the start of the game, your main win condition is to get rid of all settlers, towns, and cities.
Yeah.
When you get enough fear in your fear pool so that there's no left, and you know, you've gone through all the fear, you empty your fear pool, you draw a fear card, which gives you a bonus positive effect on the start of the settler phase. And then if you get enough fear cards, your win condition becomes easier.
Yeah, so what that is you start with 4 fear per player in the game. You generate some cards will generate their own fear. One spirit in particular, the Shadow Spirit, will usually just generate 2 fear per card that it plays. In addition, you generate fear when you remove villages and cities from the map.
Villages generate 1 fear, cities generate 2.
Yeah, when they're destroyed. So if you remove all the tokens from the pool of fear, which is 4 per player, then you draw a new fear card. And like you said, that performs its own action before the settlers get their turn. It's always something bad against the settlers. The ones that we encountered were, if there is a settler and a village in the same space, you destroy the settler. Another one was each player just gets to remove 1 settler from the board entirely, wherever they want, just 1 settler. So they can be very good and very helpful. So getting to that first fear card is very important. And then once you have gone through 3 fear cards, that's when you unlock the next win condition modification.
And so that second tier will make it so you win when you get rid of all towns and cities, but you can have the actual people still on the board.
Yes.
And then that also buffs your fear cards. They have 3 tiers of benefits as well.
Yes.
And then once you've gone through, I think it's three more
yes.
fear cards, you get your third win condition, which is just get rid of all cities, which should be pretty easy by then.
Mm-hmm. So yeah,
definitely get to that first fear card as soon as possible.
So we mentioned pushing and gathering. This is a mechanic in this game where when you gather, you select a territory on the board, and then you may collect from adjacent territories the type of piece that the effect is telling you to collect. So if you gather Dahan huts, then you select a territory, and then you look at the territories around it, and you can pick Dahan huts from those territories and move them to the one that you're gathering into. And the same thing happens if you're gathering colonists or villages. You just grab them from adjacent areas and bring them all together into one space. Then pushing is the opposite. So you choose a space that has stuff in it, and you push it to adjacent territory. So you pick a territory with people or huts or villages, and whatever the card states, you can push that to an adjacent territory.
And this is, you can split up the ones you're pushing.
Yes.
Much like you can gather from different spaces on the
board. So this is a very cool and tricky mechanic that you can do a lot of neat things with. And it's very useful. You can almost consider it to be just as good as dealing damage, except it's more versatile because you don't have to deal three damage to push a city.
Yeah,
you can just push a city if the card says you can't.
Let's talk about the concept of time walking. I'm just going to say this really quick. This is something I like to talk about in talking about games where if an effect basically means that you're skipping a turn, either for a player or, you know, the NPC in this case, very good.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, if you move settlers off of a space, so let's say you move it off the space that's on the build card. So, like, if wetland's going to be built, you move them off that, then nothing's going to be built there. Also, since they're already off the wetlands, nothing's going to be dealt damage to the wetlands.
Yeah, nothing's going to be ravaged there.
Yeah. So, it can be very huge if you can move settlers off of the, you know, next two things that you're thinking about.
Yeah.
Usually, what's right now on the build, or especially right now on the explore, you want to play the card to move those.
Right. There was a point in our game where there was probably five turns in a row where there was no wetlands being interacted with. And because of that, a lot of the... We had moved a lot of settlers and villages and stuff to wetlands earlier in the game, and they just did nothing for most of the game. They were explored from at some points, but they did no building and they did no ravaging, which was very good. So, we can just talk a little bit about the sort of the tricks that you can do with gathering and pushing. So first of all,
we talked about the skipping the building or ravaging phases by moving.
So
them.
Push villagers off of places where they would build and push buildings and villagers off of places where they would ravage.
Buildings if you can, because those deal more damage.
Yes. Now you can also push and gather the Dahan. So you can set up those situations that we talked about where you put one Dahan in a territory with one settler, which would knock it off the board.
Or
you put two Dahan in a village in a territory with a settler in a village. The territory will get a blight, but at least the Dahan will destroy the village.
Or if you can defend in that territory, you can move a lot of Dahan in there, like three, and then just have the Dahan wipe out the
intruders. There's a couple instances where this came up where we had about three Dahan in a territory. And that territory had, you know, sometimes it had two settlers in a city, sometimes it had one settler in a city, or it had three settlers in a village. But either way, the Dahan were going to deal six damage, and the opponent was going to deal around four or five damage. And we were able to defend in that territory enough damage. Like, defending three in a territory with a city and two settlers is huge.
Yeah.
Because, or not, in a city and a settler.
Because lowers it to one.
It lowers it to one damage, which means they don't give a blight. And then when we had those, you know, at least 4 to 6 damage of Dahan, the Dahan don't get destroyed because there was only one damage dealt, and they wipe everything out. It's a huge swing.
And then you get two fear for the city.
Yes. Yeah. And defense is very good for defense is very good for the Dahan, and manipulating the Dahan with pushing and gathering is a mm-hmm. very useful tool.
There's something really cool both of us really got to do with gathering, mm-hmm. but you did it more so on your turn.
Right.
So there are major powers which do more.
Yeah, I suppose we should talk about minor and major powers. Oh, yeah. I don't think we start. So we mentioned that you start with four powers in your hand.
Unique to your spirit.
Unique to your spirit. And you play them, and you get them back by reclaiming them. You also start with a ordered deck of powers to the side.
In the beginner mode.
And you know what cards are there. You can look through them. And there's certain... On your turn, at the beginning of your turn, when you get to grow your spirit by removing presents and placing it on the board and reclaiming cards, you also can add cards from that deck to your hand, just starting at the top and going down. Anyways, the minor powers are just about as good as the powers you start with. They just do a few different things than you're able mm-hmm. to do from the beginning. But eventually you get to a major power. Which is a very strong power. When you acquire it, you have to get rid of one of the powers you already have for the rest of the game. You have to forget a power because it's so powerful. They're super powerful.
The ones that we played also had bonuses you get with elements
yes.
in play, much like your innate powers.
Yes, and so you had to be careful when playing them. Mine actually... had a drawback if I didn't have the right mm-hmm. element, so I had to very carefully plan that. But so what you were saying is what happened in our game was the major powers that we acquired first in our decks were powers that destroyed a whole lot of pieces on one space. They were like a nuke, mm-hmm. and I had gathered on one particular space a whole lot like
almost
pieces.
Half the board's worth
yeah there pieces. Was there was at least two villages, there was a city, and there must have been a dozen settlers yeah. all in one space. Luckily this was a wetland space, which as I mentioned in our game was never touched. They didn't ravage it, they didn't build there, they didn't explore there. It was just this island of pieces that did nothing. And then by the time that they were about to do something, I had drawn my major power, which was this giant nuke that destroyed everything on the space. So we got very lucky that the game ended up panning out that way. And certainly we could have planned that, at least to an extent. We couldn't have planned that the wetlands wouldn't have been explored and ravaged and built on so much in that game. But we would have been able to say, like, okay, well, I've got this card coming up, this giant nuke. So if I can get to it in time, then I want to play it when I've gathered up everything. So I want to use all my pushing and gathering to put all my stuff on one space.
I mean, we certainly did plan for it. I know I also had one that dealt a lot of damage and generated a lot of fear to mm-hmm. one space, and I definitely planned like three turns ahead to make sure I'd have enough energy and enough playable cards to get the element requirements.
Sure, I'm saying we could have technically planned that from the beginning
of
the game.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Knowing that we have yeah. those cards eventually. And
really, I think that just boils down to learn your spirit, know how it works, know how it plays... know what kind of tricks it can do. Mm-hmm. Like, my spirit, the vital strength of the earth, was one that... Oh, really quick, you can only have at most two spirit in a single space... Or two presence of your own presence in a single space. That's what we call a two-stack. But so, like, with the vital strength, if I have one of those two stacks in a space, that automatically defends three.
Right.
Remember, so, like, I was putting myself in places that would normally be dangerous... because I knew I would defend and then help the Dahan fight back.
Right. Remember that the spirits, the presents, are the tokens that the spirit puts on the map.
Yeah.
And you place them there when you use your growth action at the beginning of a turn. You remove them from that tracker and you put them on the board. And yes, you technically have the option when you grow your presents and place presents on the board, you have the option to put your presence on top of one that you already placed on the board to make...
Sometimes you have to because you have a range of zero. Well,
you start the game with a two-stack on the board. In your setup for your spirit, it tells you that you put two presents on one space and one presence on another space. So you have to start that way, at least with all the beginner spirits.
Not the river.
Really?
River surges in sunlight, put one in three.
Most of the beginner
wetlands.
Spirits, you start with a stack of two. And you need a stack of two because some of the... actions you take, some of the cards, the powers, they have a range that's determined by distance from a stack of two presents. So if you have no stacks of two presents, then you can't use those abilities. And they're always usually very strong. Okay.
Yeah, I think that's about it for strategy on my end.
I wanted to just mention when we hit about the mid-game and the late game in this game. In the mid-game, it felt that occurred once we had placed somewhere around 5 and 6 presents off of our boards. At least with the way that the progression works, usually after you've removed 3 presents from a tracker on your card, you have unlocked the next tier. There's different progressions for each spirit. They start with different amounts of energy gain and different amounts of card playing abilities, and they grow at different rates. But usually about after 3 tokens have been removed from either track, both of those have increased by 1 or 2. And it felt that around that point, you know, when we started, we could only play 1 or 2 cards per turn per spirit, which wasn't enough to manage the explorers. But by the midpoint in the game, when we could each play like 3 cards each and we had enough spirit to do so, then we could really start to get a hold of the game and start swinging it more into our favor. So it felt like that's the mid game when you've done that, and at that point you can start to expect to, instead of reacting to what the explorers are doing, you can start to be proactive. And by being proactive, you reach a point which I've deemed the late game, when you've really taken control. And that is, so I mentioned that at the beginning of the game, and for most of the game during the explore phase, the settlers will reach every territory of the type that they're exploring. So every sand territory will have a village next to it, or it'll be on the coast. So every sand territory will have a settler placed in it. The late game is when you can start to prevent that from happening. So we mentioned at the beginning that it's very good to destroy the settlers while they're young so that they can't build into buildings and then blight the land. But it's even better to cut that off even further down the neck, even further closer to the head, where you prevent them from even exploring to a territory. So you don't even have to deal that one damage to the settler that explored there. You don't have to do anything because nothing happens in the territory. They don't get explored, they don't get built on, they don't get ravaged. But that only happens in the late game once you've pushed enough buildings back or destroyed enough buildings so that you have this clear space in the middle of the board.
Yeah, because they'll always be able to explore from the coastline.
Yeah.
So you might as well push the buildings out to the coastline so that they can't go from the buildings inland.
Yes.
And we only did that for, I think, 1 space, really, during the game.
Well, yeah.
But it was so good.
Exactly.
It was so helpful,
too. Once that had happened, we'd really gained control. Because you're only able to do that when you're not reacting to the people. To the settlers. When you're reacting, then that means you're dealing damage to the ones that already exist, and you're pushing back the ones that are already placed on the board. But when you can start to be proactive, because you have the excess of resources, you have the extra spirit and the extra cards to spend on it, that's when you can start to plan out areas where the settlers just can't touch for the rest of the game.
Another good indicator of late game is when you're going through about 80% of your fear every turn or every round.
Oh, yeah.
Because that means that you only have X many turns before you get to your easier win condition. You can kind of think about that accordingly.
Sure.
You know, we happen to be able to destroy all towns and cities on a later turn when we had that effect, but I mean that was also because we were generating a lot of fear towards the end.
Yeah, because we were destroying a lot of towns, but we were also just generating a lot of fear from playing a great deal of cards per turn. So let's talk about the design of the game.
Oh boy.
So this is a cooperative game, and I want to say something first that this game does very well for being a cooperative game, and that it prevents the single player aspect of a cooperative game.
Quarterbacking. This is something I tweeted about to tease the episode.
Yes.
Quarterbacking
is, I'm sure any of you who have played a cooperative game will probably have experienced this to some extent, especially in simpler games like Forbidden Island or Forbidden Desert. And that is, it's a cooperative game, but it feels like one person's playing, really.
Because one person will see the situation, and they'll notice something or have insight, and then they'll just kind of direct everybody else because they know how to win from there.
Right, so it's not four players, each with their own individual character that can do something interesting. It's one person controlling the four players to have the most optimal turns and use their abilities in the most optimal ways.
I mean, I think this is just a natural human thing, and, like, for one person to take charge, but even then,
and, I mean,
it can be worse in certain
games. It can feel bad, and, I mean, it is a cooperative game, so technically, if in the end everybody wins, then everybody wins, but
right.
It can feel bad when you're not really doing much in the game. And one person's really taking control of it.
Yeah.
So what this game does to prevent that is that it makes each person's individual tactics very complicated.
Yeah, it makes it complex, but with a purpose.
Yeah, so everything is written on these cards. All the players' actions are written on these cards. Every player's progression, their spirit's growth is very different from the other ones.
Every spirit has different innate powers with different uses. And
yes, so it's too much to track. And I mean, every card gives different amounts of elements, and so playing the cards in certain combinations will be better because you would have those elements gathering together for those innate bonuses.
And so, really, like, since there's eight spirits, it's really hard to get to the point where you're familiar with all of them.
Right.
Almost impossible,
I think,
unless you play the game very, very often.
In this game, we could really only track for each player one card that they had available to them and one innate power amongst the group.
And those were, like, the very useful ones.
Yes.
Like, the lightning one that gives other people speed, one that gave other people energy.
Yeah, and your innate power
to double a
card. Those were the only things I was able to really track across the entire game. Everything else just kind of came and went, and I really only focused on my own cards.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good thing. And that also makes the game a little more difficult than other cooperative games, because you don't necessarily have an entirely holistic view of your options. You can't always make the best play because you don't exactly know what you have available to you to make that best play. And so it makes the game a little more difficult, but that's a good thing in a cooperative game because it's you versus the game.
I think it's telling that the language that at least I used during the game was less of "you need to do this" and more do you have the ability to do this?
Right. And sometimes it wasn't even that. Sometimes I was just saying, what do you have?
Yeah, like, what do you think you're going to do?
Yeah.
What are you thinking of here?
Yeah, and depending on the spirit you play, sometimes you base your turn on what somebody else does. And that's a pretty interesting thing that doesn't happen a lot of times.
Yeah, it really...
In a cooperative game, it's not like, I want you to do that so I can do this. It's more like, what are you going to do? Because I'm deciding what I want to do around your decision.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting. It doesn't just feel like players have, you know, a mechanical thing that they're assigned. It's also that, like, you know, mentally they have to do calculations
mm-hmm.
that only they can do.
Yeah, players have a lot of agency in this game.
Honestly,
which is very good.
I mean, it's not usually a great thing to have all these complicated things going on, but since it's a cooperative game, it's okay.
Yes.
If it was competitive, that would probably be bad because it's too much for players to worry about an opponent.
Mm-hmm.
But since you're working together, you can kind of just trust that other players can figure it out.
Mm-hmm. Plus, at least all of the complication in this game is given to the players. Like, all of their actions and what they do
and
things that they have at their disposal is only... The complication is all weighted on the player side of the game.
For
the enemies are completely basic and readable.
Automatic, yeah.
All that they do is they go to the territories on the first card, they build on the territories on the second card, they ravage the territories on the third card. You can always see these three cards at all points in time.
And it also pretty much all happens at the start of a round before the rest of the things play out, so it doesn't break up the pacing too much.
Right, yeah.
You know,
we mentioned in our last episode in Champions of Midgard that all that combat in the game happens at the end of a round, so that it doesn't break up your thought process in your strategizing in the middle of a turn where you have to just drop everything and do a combat and then get back into the mindset of how you're playing. It's the same thing in this game where, you know, all of the planning and the strategizing is front-loaded on a turn. And then the rest of the turn just kind of plays out in a very methodical way, mm-hmm. with very little decision making. Let's see. You keep mentioning that the spirits have very... Oh, go ahead.
I was also going to say, a nice thing, though, is that spirits still have a built-in gating form of complexity through presence, since you usually start out with the ability to play one card, either through the amount of energy you get or your card plays, then you're not going to really be worrying about your innate powers from turn one, since you almost always need two cards at least to use your first one.
Mm-hmm.
And then your growth options, like, you don't need to take the add a power card first. You'd usually take, like, add presence to some amount and maybe get energy. And so it naturally kind of flows into, like, first round, you're not going to really be worrying about super amounts of complexity still. And the next round, you might try to play your innate power, might try to get a new card, and... Yeah, like, it gates the complexity really well through all that.
Yeah, this is a pretty complex game because of all these cards that you have at your disposal and how many things you're sort of trying to juggle between, you know, at least managing the blight that gets added to the land while also acting early upon the invader's actions. But it does well to sort of reduce that complexity, at least at the beginning of the game, by saying you only have four cards and you can't play all of them.
Also, something nice about the way the board is handled is each player starts on their own, like, segment of board, their own, like, physical tile.
Mm-hmm.
And... since your range is pretty small on both your powers and your adding presence, you really only care about your own board for maybe the first two rounds.
Yeah.
And that makes it a lot easier to manage the invaders coming in, because you only really have to manage about the ones that are near you. I know in some games, like even Pandemic, it can be a lot to, like, get dealt a huge board and then be like, okay, what's the first priority?
Right,
but in this one, it's kind of just the immediate problem of what's near you.
Yeah, not only does it start small with, like, all the cards that you have, but it also starts small with where you can go with them. Because, yeah, like you said, the most of the cards only have a range of 1 or 0. So when you look at the board at the very beginning, you start in your own quadrant, and you're only looking at the spaces around your pieces in that quadrant. It focuses you for the beginning of the game, which is very good, because then it gives you a chance to see how your cards work and which cards are better than others and what situations you should play your cards in. And it doesn't force you to think globally until, like, two or three turns after, once you've spread your presence to the edges of your territory.
And I guess this is more of a strategy thing, but if you don't know which board you'll need to expand your presence to, you can always just go more inland, because the boards, depending on the number of players, are always set up so that there is a middle
mm-hmm.
that you can go to, and
right.
that you can branch out easily from there. So yeah, you were talking about how each spirit has different play styles, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to mention that sort of what the game does to design, or what the game design does to that effect.
Yeah, so obviously there's a ton of mechanics and a ton of knobs that are adjusted.
Mm-hmm.
Each spirit is, like, at least the four main ones are, like, an elemental thing. And then I think two of the harder ones are more elemental. Two are more, like, figureheads. And I think the theming really helps with this, because each spirit, in both their playstyle based on spacing, playstyle based on effects, all that is based on how the element would think it would work.
Yeah.
So, the lightning is fast. It helps people make fast actions, but it also is just powerful at the start.
It has an innate ability to make its own actions fast.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's all about speed, and it's lightning, so of course. And yes, it has a very fast start. It explodes, and then it doesn't progress very far compared to the other spirits.
River surges like sunlight. Mm-hmm. That's what the water one that we started in the beginner game with. And that one starts with more presence in different areas. It starts with 3 presence on 3 different wetlands.
Mm-hmm.
But then those are counted as 2 stacks if it just has 1 on there. So, like, that's really good at moving out quickly into wetlands and then further and flooding.
Mm-hmm.
And it also has one of its growth options puts 2 presence on the board.
Mm-hmm.
So it's much quicker at building up their sort of energy and cards played.
Right.
I had Vital Strength of the Earth, which wanted to make a few very strong mountains. It wanted to protect the Dahan by building up presence on there.
Yeah.
So it defended there.
Your character, whenever it had two presence on the same space, that space always had a defense of three.
Yeah, so it was really defensive in both. I mean, it gave shelter to the Dahan, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But
it also didn't spread very far.
Yeah.
It wanted to keep to itself and strengthen just a few territories clustered
together
rather than spread to the far reaches, you know.
And then you had Shadows flicker like flame, which made a ton of fear.
Yes, it made a ton of fear, and it had a very slow start, I think, compared mm-hmm. to every other thing. It started by only being able to play one card, and it didn't generate any energy to start with. But it ramped up very quickly. Yeah, every time I increased the cards would always increase, and the energy went from 0 to 1 to 3.
And what's also worth noting is you had a card. You were like the only one with a card of a range of 2.
Yeah,
and I think so. The flavor of that is like you have like your central fire that builds up, but then you cast shadows further out.
Okay. Yeah, I can see that.
That's what it seems like.
Sure. Yeah. And I think I did have some decent. Well, no, I didn't really have decent damage dealing, but I had a lot of good pushing.
Yeah, you had a lot of good movement to generally scare people around.
Yeah, I guess you could. Yeah, that's sort of the flavor of my card. Was he?
Because it's not the flame. The flame isn't the main part. It's the shadows.
Yes.
The scary shadows.
Yes.
So that's the spirits. I think. Other aesthetic things that it helps a lot with
mm-hmm.
is that, kind of funny, the bad pieces, the settlers, are all plastic,
mm-hmm.
and the good pieces are all wood and cardboard.
So your presence and the Dahan huts are all made out of wood. Yeah, that is kind of funny.
Yeah, it's like just very outright natural versus man-made.
Yeah.
I do like there are risks involved in the game, because even though the explorer or the settler actions ramp up in harshness the further it goes to the left, they're all still relevant. And even then, like, you don't lose until you run out of blight, or at least, like, you know, when you run out of presence by blight being put on spaces.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, like, there is a time where the person playing the lightning had 3 spaces with presence, and one of them was in between the other two, and so they're able to, you know, be okay with putting blight there and losing that presence, because it didn't matter. They still had other 2 spaces that covered the same ground.
You know, I think I don't think we mentioned that whenever blight is put on a territory, you remove your presence from...
You remove one presence.
Yeah, that's kind of an important thing. But yeah, whenever blight is placed on a territory, whenever the villagers deal 2 damage to it, you remove any presence. You remove one of your presence from that territory.
I think it's good because, like...
And you destroy that presence.
The biggest comparison to this game is Pandemic,
mm-hmm.
in the terms of the deck and then placing stuff on the board based on the deck. In Pandemic, there's not really much of a reason to take risks. It's mainly just look at the immediate things you think are going to come up.
Yeah.
The risk is really just, will it be drawn or not? But in this one, the risk is like, is it okay to take damage here?
Yeah.
When there's other things pressing. And I think the decision-making is a lot more deep than other cooperative games.
Yeah, because of how the explorers are designed, which I think is very well designed. Yes, it's very... You're given every opportunity to take these calculated risks and to predict and to plan for the future, because the only mystery with what the explorers are going to do is what the next land they're going to explore is. But then after that's revealed, you still have 3 turns before it becomes a huge problem. So the game gives you a lot of time to plan. It gives you a lot of time to choose where you're going to take your battles. It forces you to plan because your actions are slow and they can't affect the explorers for that turn. And plus I do like just the way that it just works. Like it's logical that they explore a land from the coast or from their own towns, they establish themselves there, and then they inflict blight upon the land. It's a very logical progression, and it's very cool that it just kind of works as this continuously engine that's building on top of itself. It's like the explorers build the building so that they can explore from it later, and they build a building so that they can blight, and then, you know, if you know, it's a slow, it takes multiple turns for them to do it, so you can plan for it, but if you don't, then it can also grow out of control very quickly, because the buildings they build not only blight, but they also provide a second point for them to explore from. It's, I don't know, I just like it. It's very elegant, it's very logical, mm-hmm. it's very punishing, but it's also very manageable.
I do want to say, though, I do have one complaint.
Mm-hmm.
With all that said, it's still very confusing at times. I think as you play it, it gets easier, but, like, there's a whole lot to keep track of.
Yes, try as you might, and it's good that they try to start you slow, mm-hmm. but, you know, it's too difficult to not think globally,
yeah,
you know, early on, and when you do, it gets very complicated.
If you're not familiar with these types of games, like either cooperative games or games that have heavy engine building like this, it might be a lot to take in, because, like, there's how range works and how that relates to where you put your presence. There is, you know, how pushing and gathering work can be kind of weird at times and lead to unintuitive lines of play. When you add fear and how much, and making sure you remember when to add fear,
mm-hmm.
How damage works with in the Dahan and all that. I mean,
it's almost, I mean, this game is, I think most of the complexity comes from the fact that it's asking you to have, like, two different mindsets at the same time. You have to not only be considering what is happening this turn, in case there's an immediate threat that has grown to a boiling point that needs to be managed this turn, but you also need to think three turns ahead. So you have to have this mindset that's thinking three turns ahead for the ones that are beginning to explore and build, and it's thinking about what's happening right now on this turn. And that can pull you in different directions.
But
it's like multitasking. Mm-hmm. And you know, you're given as much time as you need to think and plan about it, but it can be frustrating and it can be a lot to take in and a lot to consider.
But
there's a couple times too where this problem occurred, because we were thinking, like, oh, hey, if we push this guy that way, then that means we're going to clear up this area, nobody's going to explore to it. So we did it, and then we looked, and then we were like, oh, we forgot that they were going to explore there. So now our plans are gone.
Though,
we forgot they were going to build in a certain area.
Even then, it's not a game you're supposed to play optimally. I think the fact that you can't really do a perfect, you know, plan or move is mm-hmm. just part of what makes it a good cooperative game.
Sure. Yeah, because it's
I think that's part of the fun of even cooperative video games, is when things don't go the way you want it to.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to scramble. You know, think of, like, a heist movie. Like, heist movies aren't fun until the plan goes wrong, and then it gets really fun.
Sure. Yeah, that's true. So you should have that mindset going into this game, that it's a cooperative game, but your turns aren't going to be the correct turns, and that's okay, because this game gives you, it gives you three turns to fix it.
Sure. Yeah, maybe that's one way to look at it.
Yeah, that's one way to look at it. The game gives you three turns to fix your issues before it starts to pile up against you. But even then, you know, you have so many blight tokens that it's not over if you let something grow unchecked. I think in the game that we played, two territories on the map were left unchecked for pretty much the whole game. There was, like, a territory in one quadrant of the board, and then all the way on the other side of the board there was another territory that kind of just got left alone, and we just had to let that happen. Mm-hmm. And we just stayed away from it until the end.
Yeah.
And then we blew it up when we could manage it. Okay.
Alright.
So that's Spirit Island.
Yep.
Thanks for listening. We
similar games.
Pandemic.
Mentioned Pandemic.
Yeah.
Sentinels of the Multiverse is another character-driven cooperative game.
Mm-hmm. It has cards and abilities.
And in that one, it's superheroes, but it's still, you know, each character plays differently.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Yeah, I mean, maybe I just haven't played enough cooperative games, but I can't think of a whole lot else like this.
Yeah, I think Sentinels is a good suggestion. If you're looking for a very similar game, check out Sentinels of the Multiverse.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's our episode on Spirit Island.
We're probably going to revisit it some point in the future.
Yeah, so with these cooperative games, you know, they have the option of ramping up the difficulty even further.
They tend to have scenarios and
yeah, like, and this campaigns. One is no different. There's scenarios where you can pick a specific kind of enemy for the colonials, and that changes sort of how they start out and how they act throughout the game.
And if you want to use the harder four spirits, you don't actually have those personal decks of power cards.
Yeah, you get to just pick your own.
You put them all in a single deck, and when you gain a power card, you look at like the top four cards of the deck and get one.
Okay, interesting.
So it's a bit harder to plan around your power cards.
Yeah, so we'll probably revisit this game in the future once we've played a more complicated version of the game.
I do want
this can also be played single player.
Oh, yeah. I do want to announce, next month, July, we are going to be doing an expansion month.
Yes.
We're going to talk about expansions for games we've already covered, since expansions for games are a common thing in games.
Oh, yeah. There's, I mean, any popular game
is going to have,
at least two expansions. And we
or
have,
versions or whatever.
Yeah. And so we've got a bunch of those, and we would like to talk about them, how they affect the game. So that'll be in July.
And if you have anything you specifically want us to cover that we've, you know, covered the base game in our previous episodes, make sure to tweet us at BG Bros Cast.
Mm-hmm. And you can follow us at that Twitter.
Yeah.
And at Facebook at the same name for information and updates.
Yep.
You can go to our website, BGBcast.com, where we post all our episodes and we categorize them so you can check it out. We also got a pretty cool advertisement there.
Oh, yeah.
For something that we talk about later in this end of episode bumper.
You can also find our related content on other websites, namely entertainthegeeky.com, where our friends Chris, Roger, and Jason host podcasts, mainly talking about nerd culture, you know, just general comics, movies, games, what have you.
Right, and it's on that website where you can also find our merch. That's where we have our Board Game Bros t-shirts, which I believe should be up and available at this moment. So go there and check it out and get a t-shirt. We have a really cool logo, in my opinion, and wouldn't it be cool to have that on a shirt? We also are selling our one-page role-playing game, Merle's Truck Stop in Maine. It's normally $5, but you can get it for free at the moment with promo code GEEKY. That's G-E-E-K-Y for a free copy of Merle's Truck Stop in Maine. And at all of these websites and social media accounts, you can find information regarding our Kickstarter, which will be kickstarting our very own game and our very own board gaming company that we're very excited to share with you and to talk to you about. That Kickstarter is coming very soon, so keep your eyes peeled for that. Isn't that a gross saying, keep your eyes peeled?
Yeah.
Anyways... Yeah, so look out for it. It's our Kickstarter. We are kickstarting our company and our very first game, which is the bluffing and deduction game Conniving Cooks, in which each player is a cook attempting to serve food to customers while also tricking their opponents into serving the incorrect food to the customers and getting them fired.
Yeah, also we don't have shirts up yet.
We don't have
shirts. We're going to get on that as soon as possible.
Yeah, as soon as possible. Okay, hopefully by the time you listen to this,
we'll make
a
tweet about it.
Oh, yeah. Well, follow us on Twitter to have information regarding the shirts. All right.
All right.
Thanks for listening to our episode on Spirit Island. Take it easy.
See ya.